Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Thanks for listening to NPR News today. Political observers joke that Democrats exist in a perpetual state of anxiety. In fact, Google the words Democrats and anxiety and your screen will fill with the clenched fears and teeth-grinding consternation of the party that runs both chambers of Congress and the White House for now. But a post-mortem of the 2020 election by several high-profile Democratic groups uncovered some concerning trends for the party. And here's a couple of highlights we're going to talk about. Republicans were largely successful in branding Republicans as radicals. And many voters of color are what's known as persuasion voters. They need to be convinced to vote for Democrats. So we're going to dig into those findings and more with our guests. Boy, I'd love to hear from you on this. And I'm looking for Democrats and independents of all ages and all kind of levels of party loyalty. I'd like to hear from some true blue DFLers in Minnesota and in the states around us. If you're an independent voter, I'd love to hear from you. If you are a young activist in the party as a Democrat or an independent, boy, I'd love to hear your assessment as well, because this is going to be your party. So if you identify as a Democrat or an independent who often votes with the Democrats, does the party's hold on power in Washington and in some of the state houses feel tenuous to you? What do you think of the success that Republicans had labeling Democrats as quote-unquote radicals? Democrats of all stripes, all kinds of loyalty to the party, independents want to hear from you. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. Tweet in at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Amy Allison is with us, the founder of She the People, and with us from Oakland, California. Amy, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Marcella Mulholland is the political director at Data for Progress and with us from Brooklyn. And Marcella, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Amy, I want to go straight to what seems, I have to say, it seems like a kind of a counterintuitive conclusion here from the report. Donald Trump overall got a very small percentage of voters of color in the 2020 election. 8% of African Americans, according to AP vote cast. He increased his share of Hispanic voters in states like Florida, Texas, and Arizona. But this audit calls these voters, many of these voters, persuasion voters who need to be convinced that they should be supporting Democrats. What does that mean to you?
It means that the way that we've been conducting the business of campaigns and elections needs to be different this cycle. And what I mean is, it's pretty irrefutable that despite the voter suppression efforts for many years, but especially in 2020, in key battleground states, Democrats were able to have victory. Look at places like Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
But in Georgia, there was an extraordinary amount of money that was invested early. It's a full year and some change before the next election. Democrats should be going door to door, investing in community organizations who really have relationships with voters, people who are both on the voter rolls and people who voted in 2020, as well as people who are eligible and did not vote. And that is the formula that is going to be required to, it's not to persuade people to vote, you know, to, it's not like a Democrat versus Republican persuasion.
Right.
It's, is this process of democracy and voting worth it? Do we see actual benefit for the community? Are they carrying my issues? And those are the ways that we need to persuade voters as Democrats to stay engaged and vote in a midterm year.
Marcella, I think I hear Amy saying, and I don't want to use the taken for granted trope. I think that's really misunderstood. But that these voters need to feel more attached, you know, kind of more of a personal loyalty with the party. And Democrats cannot just assume that they'll turn out when needed in elections. So how do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Amy's right. For a long time, the Democratic Party has just assumed that voters of color, Latino voters, Black voters are certainly going to swing blue. And I think the last election showed that that's just not the case. And Amy's right. We need to have policies and messaging as a party that really directly speaks to the needs of these voters and shows them that Democrats are going to fight for them. And I think in the 2020 presidential election, obviously with COVID being the issue that all of us were thinking about, running on a platform of providing direct stimulus checks and promising to vaccinate the country really is a way to directly connect with voters and show them that if you elect Democrats, their lives will improve in a meaningful way. And I think that's why we ultimately were able to win a governing majority. But obviously, there's more work to be done. And the trends that we saw specifically with Hispanic and Black voters defecting a little bit is cause for concern and is a reason for Democrats to be more intentional about how we're reaching these communities and talking to them about issues that they care about.
I'm going to come back on Hispanic voters. Boy, the numbers and the geography are really interesting in this. But let me take some calls to Peter, listening in St. Paul. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Hi, what'd you want to say about this?
Yeah, I hope the Democrats can do more to get over this image of being tax and spend liberals so that Democrats can get their policies going, like, you know, abortion rights, gay rights, all the other progressive issues. So we need to make sure voters know we're not going to raise their taxes.
Mm-hmm. So you're concerned, and Amy, that's an old anchor that has hung around the necks of Democrats in Washington for a long time. What it doesn't take into account is the way that Trump administration, the George W. Bush administration spent either. But it seems to be this persistent image. And Democrats, I think, in some ways have had a hard time shaking it. I expect Republicans will be talking about it again in the midterms. What do you think?
I think we just came out of in the last administration, 4 solid years of name calling. And, you know, when I look at the effect that it's had on us, that coupled with really serious disinformation targeted at amongst others, Latinos and Black people in this country. It's had an effect, but mostly a chilling effect where people don't want to engage in political dialogue. They don't see politics as the art of the possible and compromise and discussion as part of the democratic process. So it's had a chilling effect overall. But I would say that the biggest enemy isn't the name calling that, you know, the Republicans might put, you know, as it's not really an albatross when you look at Americans are less likely to cross party lines. The midterms are going to be really decided on turnout and the battle between turnout, as we were talking about earlier, and voter suppression in key areas. Look at Florida. Florida has, you know, the Senate race may hang in the balance. There is the Marco Rubio, who is a Trump acolyte, and Val Demings is a challenger in the primary, Democratic primary, who's a Black woman who's comes from a law enforcement background. And you look at races like that and say, look, Democrats are the Republican led legislature in Florida has passed a lot of laws signed by the governor to limit people's voting rights. And that, you know, magnified by states all over the country could have more of an impact than name calling on the results of the midterm.
Got it. And I'm not going to underestimate the effect of voter suppression, Marcella. But I've also wondered if it is going to have a rallying or opposite effect that some of these GOP-led legislators think it might. I mean, that work is going on right now to counter the effect of some of these voter suppression laws. And by any objective measure, they are suppressing the rights of some communities to vote. But I wonder if it is going to have a galvanizing effect. What do you think?
I mean, I think you're certainly right. It's pretty insidious to see how the GOP state legislatures across the country have swiftly moved to restrict voting rights, especially in key swing states like Georgia that were so critical in swinging the election toward Biden. And I think you're right. This is a backlash to the fact that Democrats won power, and now the Republican Party has clearly shown that they are willing to stop at no end to ensure the political success of their party moving forward, whether that's an insurrection at the Capitol, whether that's passing restrictive voting rights bills across the country. And I think, you know, it's the history is still to be written about how this affects the 2020 midterms. I think at Data for Progress, we're really keeping an eye out for any trends in partisan mobilization, which is essentially the idea that Democrats may be less motivated to vote because Trump is out of office, whereas Republicans are more motivated. And it's really important that Democrats stay consistently engaged and hold Congress accountable to passing the Democratic platform that Joe Biden won on and then winning in 2022 as well.
Conversation this morning, if you've just tuned in, on a post-mortem report that was done by several high-profile Democratic groups that uncovered some concerning trends for the party. It's interesting because, of course, Democrats are at the moment running the House and Senate and the White House, but Republicans, with some of the highlights, as noted, Republicans were largely successful in some districts, in some areas and states, in branding Democrats as radicals. And there are a number of voters of color that the report says are persuasion voters. Our guests are saying they need to be activated. They need to feel attached to the party. And then they need to be activated during elections before and after, by the way, too. So if you identify as a Democrat or an independent who leans with Democrats, how does the party's hold on power in Washington and in state houses feel to you? And I'm interested in what you think of the success that Republicans had labeling Democrats as radicals. Now, I want to hear from you. If you've been in the party for a long time, would love to hear your insight on this. If you are a younger activist or a loyal party member, you usually vote Democratic, you believe in the agenda, maybe you're in your 20s or 30s, I'd love to know where you think the future of the party is. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 to Gina in Farmington, Minnesota. Hi, Gina.
Hi.
Hi. What do you want to say about this?
So I wanted to say that I've been a Democrat for a long time. I've been a member of the DFL. However, I'm also a strong Bernie Sanders supporter, and I worked for his campaign, and I believe in all of his issues. So I'm a progressive Democrat, mm-hmm. and I feel like Democrats kind of lost that platform. And a lot of us progressives did vote Democrat because of Trump, but I don't think it will happen again. And I feel like we need a new party.
When you say it won't happen again, do you mean you could be persuaded by a candidate on the other of the other party, or we're just not going to be activated to turn out?
I will never be a Republican. So if we just won't be activated to turn out. I honestly did not want to vote for Biden, but I wanted Trump out of the office.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like Democrats, they lost. I think the core issues that I thought they were about, they're not about Medicare for all, and a lot of things that progressive Democrats feel are important.
This is really, thanks, Gina, for the call. Marcella, this is no small challenge for the party, right, to keep that progressive wing of the party activated and interested. What do you say to what Gina's described?
I mean, I think Gina's expressing a very real frustration that a lot of people have with the Democratic Party, which is that voters across the country often feel like neither party is really advocating for their interests. And there's a wide array of issues where our political system has really failed to make progress over the last several years. Gina mentioned Medicare for All. Obviously, the ACA was really critical in expanding coverage, but there is still a lot of work to be done. I think with the climate crisis, it's a really evident that our political system has really fallen short of mobilizing our economy to take on the climate crisis in the way that's necessary. So I think, you know, I certainly resonate with Gina's frustration with feeling like our political system isn't really looking out for people like us. That being said, I think the future is bright for the Democratic Party if they are responsive to the political times that we live in. So, you know, some people, like you mentioned, might say that the party is veering too far left, but I actually feel like the Democratic Party is just responding to the political, environmental, and economic context in which we live, which is, like I said, with the climate crisis, with COVID, with student debt, police brutality, skyrocketing childcare costs. Like, we live in a moment of intersecting crises where increasingly working families, working people are really having trouble meeting their basic needs. So we need a Democratic Party and a political system that can meet the scale of these crises and pass policies that actually help working people across the country. And I think if Democrats do that between now and 2022 and beyond, that's a more compelling case to make to voters like Gina, who feel really left behind by our political system.
So, Amy, I want to follow on some of what Marcella said there, and I want to come back to this idea that labeling Democrats as radicals worked in some areas, and it worked in areas where progressives were invested in the idea of defunding the police. And I'm going to say here, it was never defund, you know, completely wipe out police departments. But I think that was misunderstood as the discussion continued. But here's something from the postmortem on this issue of police brutality and what to do about policing. In the districts we looked at, those in which law and order and socialism was a continued drumbeat also saw a larger share of Latino, AAPI, and Black voters who supported the GOP. Could you give me some insight on why that kind of branding worked with those kinds of voters?
Well, I agree that there was some problem with messaging. But if you look at one of the areas, which is a increase, it wasn't huge, but a slight increase of Latinos voting for Donald Trump in 2020 in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas, it was really more of an indication of a challenging state, what Marcella was talking about, desperation than actual values. I mean, that's a part of the state where the pandemic tripled unemployment.
Wow.
And the Republicans were smart on messaging. You know, they said, we'll get you back to work. We're going to reopen your schools. And the Democratic message was, stay at home, wear a mask. Wasn't effective. And it didn't really lean into the issues that affected people's daily lives. And so I think we're in a moment where in the midterms is a chance to lean even more, particularly because the Republicans are fighting culture wars. Well, we're fighting them too. A critical race theory is the rallying, you know, destroy critical race theory, you know, and you know, is that the rallying cry of the Republicans? They don't have much of a platform. This is an opportunity to say the Democratic Party stands for racial, economic, and gender justice. In these particular ways, we have won. And these are the things that we're proposing. And so there's a stark contrast and an opportunity for the election next year that, you know, you're not going to get 100% of any group, any, you know, Black voters or Latino voters, Asian American voters, or any group. But what the Democrats have seen, and they exercise to a certain extent and need to do more, is to say, you know, our base is this new American majority that really cares about these issues, and we're going to talk about it openly. We're going to support candidates who champion it. We're going to have energy and excitement and provide an alternative. And it's not, and then we're going to, on the ground, run campaigns that rely on organizations. Many of them, and you've heard me say this, are led by women of color who are deep in communities and have relationships, deliver those messages people care about. So it's not just stay at home, wear a mask type messaging, but it's like together we can do this. And I think that is going to be the cornerstone of successfully holding the House winning the Senate outright, and in 24, then getting reelected in the White House.
Okay, I want to follow before we go back to the phones here, because I really want to hear you specifically, Amy, if you will, on the law and order, and there was a distorted debate about that, but we are. You know, ground zero for these kinds of discussions, political discussions about policing here in the Twin Cities. Here's one more thing before you speak to that from the report. None of the candidates or campaigns included in this analysis supported defunding the police, but nearly all were targeted with paid ads claiming that they did. I don't think that kind of politicking is going to go away. And I'm interested specifically in what you think of that.
Well, you know, the activists who rightly pointed out the abuse on the hands of law enforcement have done a remarkable feat in just a few years. In my hometown of Oakland just last week, the city council voted to move $18 million from law enforcement into, you know, mental health care services and homeless services. Our school district moved $10 million. So when it comes right down to the practical implementation of something that, you know, a slogan is defund the police, but moving money around that's public dollars, it's happening all over the country. It's happening in, you know. So I think that the what we've seen are Republicans being able to hook on to particular phrases as ways to throw meat to their base and get people upset. I think this next cycle will be critical race theory. It's not going to be defund police. But I get your point. We can't, you know, in this political environment, we can't stop people from calling names or using that to rally their base. But instead of focusing on what those guys are doing, we should be focusing on expanding and strengthening our base, our turnout, defending our right to vote and giving people something to vote for. There's just more people, ultimately, who would support Democrats and who don't fall for those same messages. Those messages are intended for people who are already values-wise aligned,
right?
And they're trying to get them, you know, motivated to get
fired
out
up. That's right. Rachel says here on Twitter, while we may need progressive policies for our current political, social and economic context, Democrats must do better explaining why those policies matter. Marcella was talking about this. The majority of voters are not as far left as the Democratic voices who are loud and whom the media covers. To Nancy on the road. Hi, Nancy. Good to have you on the phone.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. Okay. I actually thought, since I might go out of range, I would pull over. I'm actually from Stillwater.
Okay.
And I'm going to sort of mirror what's just been said so eloquently, but I think the Republicans do a far better job and have not just in this election cycle, but always done a better job with sound bites. And I think the Democrats certainly have the creativity and access to smart people who could do better. I mean, defund could go to refund. These names stick. They stay with us. Tax cuts appeals to everybody. And so from the standpoint of Democrats being branded either radicals or tax and spend, there's messaging that could far improve the reality of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to focus on that. And with regard to to policy, I don't think anybody wants to hear that. I think they want to hear the specifics of, we're going to retrain you and here is our program. We're going to provide childcare services in terms of infrastructure, but that's a tricky shift, but I think it can be done. I think it can be done well, because I totally agree with your guests that there are programs that appeal to everyone, and the Republicans are much more successful at twisting the message.
Marcella? Yeah, thank you, Nancy. Marcella, what do you think?
I mean, I think she's right. Messaging is key, and the reality is that whether or not the policy that Democrats back works for people is only kind of half the equation. You need to get the policy right, and then you also need to get the politics right. Democrats, I would argue, pretty definitively have a platform that is more popular and beneficial to working people across the country. But like I said, that's half the battle. They also need to then make the case to voters that their policies will help them. I think Democrats should be really wise and careful about how they use their time communicating with the public, whether that's Joe Biden, whether it's a member of Congress. You know, their time in front of the public is limited and it's a really valuable resource. And they need to use it really wisely by talking about these policies in the most popular ways. And I think that's where polling and message testing really comes into play. So where I work is a polling firm and think tank, and we are able to poll likely voters across the country every week. And it really gives us an insight into what parts of the political conversation are resonating with voters, with which voters is it resonating with. And I think, you know, to the extent that Democrats can really be careful and thoughtful about how they message their policy platforms to the public, I think that will be really critical for the party's political success moving forward.
Marcella Mulholland with us, political director at Data for Progress, and Amy Allison with us, the founder of She the People, and a conversation about a postmortem that went on within the Democratic Party. You know, the Democrats emerged, let's say, with leadership of the House and Senate and the White House, but very small majorities and some, you know, anxiety about what 2022 is going to bring and how firm the hold is on the party, and obviously a clarion call for outreach to voters who remain persuadable and skeptical. Is that you as a Democrat or an independent who leans Democratic? What do you think of the party's agenda? What do you think of the party's messaging? Hearing from Nancy and a number of other callers here about dissatisfaction with the ways that Democrats talk about their agenda and accomplishments. What do you think of the success that Republicans had in some parts of the country in labeling Republicans as radicals? To Larry in Minneapolis. Hi, Larry. Thanks so much for waiting. Ah, Larry, are you there? Yes.
Sorry,
go ahead.
I fumbled my phone for a second there.
Okay. Go right ahead.
I happen to be a very active DFLer. I'm on two central committees, Congressional District 5 and Senate District 62. I'm also a voting alternate on the state central committee. So I've been really intensely involved. There was an earlier caller, and that's what caused me to call in about it, who was talking about how progressives are poised to leave the party. My concern is totally the opposite. I think the party has been so taken over, or on the verge of being taken over, by the ultra-progressives that they're poised to drive the moderates out of the party. You know, 30 years ago, I was considered to be a flaming liberal. Now I'm a very moderate liberal by comparison.
Uh-huh.
My positions haven't changed. The party has changed. And I'm concerned that the moderates deciding, not that they're going to vote Republican, but they're not going to vote. Or they're going to vote for one of the fringe, you know, the fringe part, what I'll call the fringe parties, like the Marijuana Now Party, those kinds of things, and allow Republicans to squeak in and cause the DFL to lose control of the House and not regain control of the Senate. I think the statewide votes, because of the density of the DFL population in the metro area, will keep most of the statewide officers in the DFL hands. But I'm really concerned about the lack of the ability to make progress. We see that on the public safety legislation that stalled out with a lot of stuff that really needed
state
to
legislature.
Get in there.
Yeah,
but couldn't.
Yeah,
and it's not. And we're not going to make progress if the flaming liberals force the moderates out of the party because they're just not willing to compromise.
So, Amy, I don't think the tension between different cohorts in the Democratic Party is new. What do you make of Larry's immediate concern about where the party is?
Well, political parties are not, always set in concrete. They evolve over with the times. If we look back in history, there were different political parties, different names, different focuses, different compositions. The Republican Party has changed dramatically in the last 4 years, last 6 years. and so has the Democratic Party. It was women of color, largely, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York and Rashida Tlaib out in Michigan and others who really changed the center of gravity so that gender and economic and racial justice is a centerpiece, so much so that the Biden-Harris administration is doing really breaking new ground, saying, look, we want to figure out how to do policymaking and practices from the White House that address racial justice and gender justice. That had never been done before. So the party is evolving. And this is a good thing because the embracing of justice politics, progressive politics, is bringing in new voters and particularly young voters. You know, we talk about messaging. It is important for parties to understand how to communicate and reach people. They can't win unless they communicate and reach young people of color, particularly young women of color.
Right.
You know, you look at AOC, she changed the game because she has her own audience of millions. On, you know, I see her Instagram lives and I look at how she's speaking in the language and the politics that move people. And the rest of the party has had to follow suit because that's where the energy is. So I think that's actually not what's going to bring the Democratic Party down. It's what's going to save it. That's what's going to make sure that it is solidly growing, where the Republican Party arguably is mostly stagnant and heavily white, and it's hardened in terms of its positions. And so it's really painted itself into a corner on one hand, where the Democratic Party is expansive, creative, and offering solutions on the other.
I'm going to talk about some of the demographic and policy problems for the Republicans in a minute. But Marcella, I wanted to ask you about this. I saw a Data for Progress poll not too long ago that said that 53% of Americans knew almost nothing or nothing about this child tax credit. That was probably one of the most important legacy policies that Joe Biden will do in this term. And it's transformational for a lot of families. How is it that so many Americans don't know what it is?
I mean, I think the reality is that most Americans aren't following politics as closely as maybe the three of us are.
Well, yeah, but I'm also talking about messaging here. I don't think you have to be... Are the Democrats taking on the challenge of something of a policy that's that important to message and message and message about it because it matters?
Oh, no, I totally agree. I think Democrats need to be relentless about talking about policies like the child tax credit that's putting cash directly into the hands of families and parents to help with child care and just the cost of having a family. I think the fact that our polling shows that a lot of voters don't know what it is or aren't expecting it really speaks to the fact that the White House and members of Congress can be doing more to really relentlessly be talking about this every time they get the opportunity to do so. So, for instance, at Data for Progress, we just launched a war room around the child tax credit to really help with the comms and political strategy of getting the word out about this, because this is kind of goes to what I was saying earlier. We got the policy right? Like, we passed something that directly benefits and improves the lives of families, of children, alleviates poverty really significantly across the country. And now the second half, which is equally as critical, is really making clear that voters know who got this passed, who in Congress and which political party is responsible for putting cash in their pockets. And so Democrats are polling shows, obviously, but need to be doing more to make it clear, because a lot of voters don't know about it. And when we explain it to them, you know, our polling shows that the expanding the CTC is really popular.
Yeah.
And I think another key way that Democrats can work on this is by making the expansion permanent or extending it for several more years, so that the relief that families saw because of the pandemic isn't just fleeting, and rather a more systemic change that supports families across the country for years to come.
Cheryl tweets, defund the police is the dumbest thing progressives have come up with in a long time, although now it has evolved to abolish the police. Democrats win for the Republicans in spite of themselves. I'm a disillusioned DFLer. Chris called to say, I'm an active, lifelong Democrat and very involved in the city. As a social justice advocate, I work with homeless populations and offenders. activate underserved populations. If the Dems focus on financial issues rather than cultural issues, they'll get better turnout. When you have no place to live, you're not worried about defunding the police. To Beth in South Minneapolis. Hi, Beth. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Carrie. This is Beth. And I want to thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My aunt and I used to be very active in the Republican Party. In 1988, we watched the born-again Christian leave the Democratic Party in droves and take over the Republican Party here in the 5th District of Minneapolis. I mean, seriously, watched them walk into my caucus and take over my caucus.
Mm-hmm.
From there, I then decided this Republican idea was not going to work. And so much so that my father and I used to really fight about this. And I finally looked at him and I said, listen, Dad, our politics aren't going to be the same anymore. I want you to give me one Republican president in my voting lifetime that has given me any of the foundational aspects of the Republican Party. How about a decreasing federal budget? How about a decreasing federal deficit?
Yeah, so Beth, if I might, because we have full
yes.
phone lines, it sounds like you've been engaged for some time in trying to figure out what the Republicans stood for. How do you feel about Democrats?
Right now, I'm happy with Joe. I'm not happy they didn't take Bernie up on it before we lost to Hillary.
Okay.
You know?
Do you vote independent?
I vote solidly independent.
But you lean with...
I lean with the Democrats
okay.
at this point. My husband's self-employed, and I work for the man, so I got a split household that way.
All right. It's good to have your view and the insight on how this works in your family, Beth. Thank you. To Danny in Rosemount. Hi, Danny. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for taking my call. It's actually Fanny, but that's okay.
I'm sorry about that. Go right ahead.
I think that I've been a Democrat all my life, and I was very complacent whenever they're in rule. But Trump got me out of that complacency. The worst thing that has happened here is they made socialism a bad word, or Trump made it a bad word. And they associate liberals with being socialists. Well, most Americans don't even know what socialism is. We as a Democratic Party need to be very clear and define what socialism is, what other countries that are socialist, what are they like, and what that means, so that it's not a bad word. Because I've heard from many people that socialism scares them. Maybe it's the ism, and it kind of reminds them of communism. So if we can educate the public on what socialism really means, and also we need to talk to people on their level. Most people don't understand the bills that go through the House and so forth. Make it very simple.
Right, not as involved.
Let them know,
yeah,
yes,
as Marcella, Sandy, I think I've got the essence of what you wanted to say. Marcella was saying to us earlier that if you are a, I don't know, mid-information voter, maybe in some ways low political information voter, maybe you're probably not following it as we are, and yet you want to activate those voters during elections. Amy, I want to ask you about some of the demographic analysis here, and then this report's conclusion. Overall, we know that the number of white voters without a college degree is shrinking. If Republicans are losing white voters who have a college degree, where do they go to find these new voters? Or is that a temporary thing because of Trump? How do you see that?
Well, it's true that the percentage of white voters in the electorate who are overwhelmingly Republican are going to, you know, it's shrinking in terms of the percentage of the electorate, while the focus on women of color, Black, Latina, Asian American, Indigenous, is the fastest growing voting bloc. And I think when you look at a multiracial inclusive coalition that's going to be required to win statewide for these Senate races and in particular districts that are up next year, you know, it's going to include white college educated voters as part of the coalition.
Mm-hmm.
I also, you know, I wanted to comment, if you don't indulge me, about the term socialist.
Yeah.
A lot of us who have been around for a while, we're used to the demonizing or the use of the word socialist from the 80s and the 90s. And, we got to look at what's really happening. If you look at New York's second biggest city, Buffalo, the Democrat who won, India Walton,
yeah, it's mind blowing.
Socialist,
oh my gosh,
and
in Buffalo,
in Buffalo,
yeah.
And we shouldn't be surprised at this.
Why?
This is what's happening in our country, all over the place. It is also very significant. She's a black woman who has a multiracial, inclusive coalition. It includes college-educated whites. It includes all across the spectrum, and it's in a place like Buffalo. And embracing democratic socialism, which is a very popular set of policies, is something that's happening not just in New York, in the South, in the Sun Belt, in California. And we can't ignore it. So it's time for us to have a new understanding of our relationship with that word and who is actually driving the policies that are going to be successful ultimately.
I'm so glad you brought up Buffalo. That's so interesting. Marcella, I want to ask you something else here from this report that speaks to ticket splitting, which we saw in Minnesota and I know we saw in a number of states. The report says some campaign teams we spoke with felt that the party, Democratic Party, didn't have a message beyond Donald Trump sucks. And this void led to split ticket voting for Biden at the top of the ticket and Republicans down ballot, leading to split outcomes in 16 districts. I mean, this is part of the reason that the House majority, that the Democratic House majority became more narrow. What do you do about that? You've got somebody at the top of the ticket, but that person's going to struggle if, you know, to get legislation through if they can't hold the House and Senate.
Yeah, I mean, I think it speaks to the fact that a lot of voters aren't super ideological in who they decide to vote for and oftentimes make decisions like you're describing where they vote for Biden at the top of the ticket and then Republicans down ballot or vice versa. And interestingly, I mean, I think with the way that our nation's politics have polarized, split ticket voting is far more rare now than it was before. But obviously in 2020, we saw it and we saw how the ramifications of that played out with the House. And I think, you know, there's only so much that's in the Democrats' control. And what's in our control is the policies that we advocate for and how we talk about them. And I would just really encourage the Democratic Party, from Joe Biden to someone running for city council, state legislature, all the way to local levels, to be, I would give them the same advice. It's really critical that we back popular policies and that we be relentless about talking to them, talking about them to voters. And I also think, you know, going into 2022, obviously there's still some time between now and then, and Democrats really have an opportunity with this infrastructure package to pass a policy that will improve people's lives in a really direct way.
Mm-hmm.
It will make sure that people have access to clean air and clean water across the country, will create millions of clean energy jobs. And I think, you know, if Democrats go into 2022 and they're able to say, look, we had a governing majority and what did we do? We passed the American Rescue Plan. We put stimulus checks in your pocket. We passed the child tax credit where we helped alleviate child poverty really significantly. We helped to tackle climate change. And this is why you should vote for us. I think that's a really compelling electoral case. Whereas the alternative could be Democrats say, you know, we won a governing majority and we weren't really able to do much on a lot of issues because Republicans didn't let us.
Hmm.
And I think Democrats should do everything that they can between now and 2022 to make sure that we're able to say, have receipts for voters and say, like, these are all the things that we did for you when we had power. And I think that's the best thing that we can do to protect from some of the split ticket voting that didn't favor Democrats in 2020.
Okay, I want to grab a call here from Peter in Arizona before we wrap up. Hi, Peter. I really appreciate you waiting. What, may I ask what part of Arizona you're in?
Central part of the state.
Okay.
It's about 100 miles north of Phoenix.
I'm curious because of what's happening with the Republican Party in Phoenix, but go right ahead.
Sure. Two things real quick. First of all, the people that have called in earlier about messaging and so on, that's all important, and I agree completely. I think it's the method. So, for example, Donald Trump became very good at tweeting, but he became very bad at what he tweeted. So that's just one platform, but why don't we tweet positive? Why doesn't the president today tweet every day, pick a positive, tweet it?
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever social platforms of use today by young people, particularly, I'm 60. I don't use Twitter, but I know of it, and I know of its power. So use those powers. Maybe they need a social media czar in the White House today.
Okay.
Manage and coordinate all social media platform messaging and make it positive messaging, not negative.
Got it. And what else? Yeah.
Second thing is, I read in the last election there were about 80 million people who didn't vote.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an independent, and I was one of them who didn't vote in past elections. I haven't voted for a number of years. I kind of felt disenfranchised with the whole process, to be quite honest.
Uh-huh.
And this past year energized me because of our former president and the shenanigans and things that I didn't agree with.
Okay, so Peter, I'm a little tight on time, Peter. Activating Amy, people who didn't vote, who it sounds like Peter's one of those voters who's just waiting to be, you know, to really be activated. They're out there. What do the Democrats do about that?
The Democrats need to put millions of dollars into the states, in Arizona, it's a particularly important
mm-hmm.
state,
yeah.
and others, to not only talk about the wins. It's been incredible what this administration's been able to accomplish in a few months, but also to paint a picture of why it's important to be to continue to get out and vote. That work starts now. We have less than 18 months, and a significant investment in organizing on the ground will make a difference come Election Day.
Yeah, just an interesting note here about Arizona, because you know you've got Senator Mark Kelly and Senator Kyrsten Sinema, both who catalyzed Hispanic voters, but overall in their states, but overall the top of the ticket. Saw some drift there, so speaks to some of what we've been talking about this hour. Amy Allison is the founder of She the People, Marcella Mulholland, political director at Data for Progress, and some really great calls and insights from all of you. Thank you for that.
NPR News with Carrie Miller is produced by Kelly Gordon and Ariana Rosas. You can hear the show live at 9 a.m. weekdays on NPR News or by subscribing to the NPR News with Carrie Miller podcast. Thanks for listening.